welcome to Hazel and Katniss and Harry and Star, a young adult literature podcast, their film and television adaptations, and everything in between. I'm Joe.
And I'm Zeus.
Well, in that case, I'm Percy.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh. Battle. Conflict. And our show is located on the ancestral lands of the Haudenosaunee, the Huron-Wendat, and the Anishinaabe on lands connected to the Toronto Purchase, Treaty 13 of 1805.
And on the Tecumloops-Tay-Sequepin territory within the unceded traditional lands of Sequepin-Ulu. And today's text, Percy Jackson and the Olympians, takes place all over the U.S., but it was filmed, of course, in Vancouver, British Columbia, the unceded traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. I was scared of
dentists in the dark. My name is Percy Jackson. Am I a troubled kid? Yeah, you could say that. Bad grades, bullies, all the normal stuff. And then there's some stuff that's maybe not so normal.
There you are.
You saw something. Something that no one else could see.
The stories that I have told you about Greek gods and half-bloods, they are real.
Mrs. Jackson, things have changed. This is all developing a lot faster than we anticipated.
Over, why is there half a goat in your pants?
So the important thing is not to panic.
Percy Jackson. We've been expecting you. The Master Bull has been stolen. That is your quest.
Remember what I taught you.
You're gonna need to be brave now.
Okay, so Brenna, we are revisiting the Percy Jackson series. Obviously, this is 8 episodes of TV for Disney Plus, but let me run you through the cast and crew quickly, and then we will get into it.
Nice.
So this is, of course, based on the book series by Rick Riordan, and it's on the first book principally, because, of course, now it's a TV show, we can do one season equals one book. So the show itself is actually show run by Dan Schatz and Jonathan E. Steinberg, who is more or less the co-producer. So he and Riordan worked on this together to pitch it to Disney. We have Walker Scobell as Percy, Leah Sava Jeffries as Annabeth, Aryan Simhendri as Grover, Charlie Bushnell as Luke, as well as Virginia Cole as Sally Jackson, that's Percy's mother, Megan Mullally as Mrs. Dodds or Alecto, Adam Copeland as Ares, Jason Manzoukas as Dionysus, Lin-Manuel Miranda as Hermes, Jay Duplass as Hades, Toby Stevens as Poseidon or Percy's father, and finally the late Lance Reddick as Zeus.
Obviously a stacked adult cast.
Yeah, as we are apt to do, right? Yeah. I mean, as soon as I started to see them cropping up in various episodes, I just thought, yeah, this is how we do it, right?
Yeah. And you know, why wouldn't you want one of your, like, guest star roles to be a god? It's fun.
Sure. Okay, so let's get into this because you worried that you were going to have to go back and reread the book, which neither one of us really loved. It's a little more middle grade verging on YA than we were fully comfortable with. Like it just felt a very sort of juvenile take on some of this material, and it didn't work as well for us. No. But you were concerned that we were going to go into the TV show and you were not going to remember the book at all. So I'm curious, how did you find this experience?
I did not remember the book at all, but
okay.
I didn't let it bother me, Joe.
Right?
Conscientious Brenna would have been like, I better read the book again, or at least listen to our podcast episode again. But I did neither of those things. Instead, I just enjoyed the show for what it is. And I did enjoy the show. I think, like, my overarching comment would be, and it gets this from the book, obviously, but, like, The episode structure relies way too heavily on one of us is going to have to sacrifice ourselves. Mm. Like, that is the central conflict in almost every single episode, is like, which one of us is staying behind and sacrificing ourselves? Ooh, let's trick each other so we're not the one sacrificing. Anyway, that is like central to every single episode. And I did get like, okay, which one is it going to be this week? but otherwise, I think it works way better than the movie.
Yeah, there's absolutely no debating the fact that the TV show is far more successful, even though these episodes, you know, they vary in length. So some of them are about 40 minutes, some of them are closer to 30. Some total over 8 episodes is roughly double, 2.5 times longer than the actual film. So I think it's just, it's able to work with more because we can spend a bit more time. Ironically enough, my criticism was that we still have to really speed through some of these conflicts, like the point where I thought this would have been better served as a 2-part episode. I don't know why we feel like we need to rush, but I guess at the end of the day, we still want to make sure we're covering the entirety of the first book by the end of the first season.
For me, the example where that's clearest is in the fight with Ares.
Oh, gosh, which is apparently extended compared to both the film and the book.
Yeah, and it is so short. It's like
so short.
He attacks him. You think he's going to lose. Poseidon comes. And then he literally stabs him once. And I know it's draws first blood wins. The whole thing happens so quickly. And you're like, wait, wasn't this a central conflict? Like, what is happening? There's definitely moments that are way too rushed. I do think that the family history gets an appropriate amount of attention in the TV series. It's done through a series. If you haven't watched the show yet, it's done through a series of flashbacks. So like periodically, either because he's daydreaming or because he's in a moment of conflict or just because he's reminiscing, Percy will reflect back on a moment between him and his mom. So instead of front loading all the relationship stuff, we build it slowly over the course of the series.
Right.
And that did work for me really well because you start off being kind of like not sure of the mom's motivation. Obviously that I did remember from the book, but like I think it's well set up, and then slowly as you learn more about the mom and more about Poseidon, like you understand more as the series progresses. So, you know, aspects like that I thought were appropriately lingered over, but yeah, there is still some rushing even in 8 episodes.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. One of the things that I like the most about this season is how much more screen time we give to Virginia Cole as Sally.
Yeah, she's so good.
I mean, she's a great actress. I think she has really good chemistry with Walker Scobell's. And, you know, we should note that there's an additional scene that's not really included in the book, or it's maybe just out of order. So in episode 7, we get this series of extended flashbacks with her where she's struggling to get Percy into different schools. And she's, you know, I think there's an earlier flashback where she's talking to him about his dad, where, you know, we're seeing this cottage for the first time. And it goes a long way to, as you said, not just establish the relationship, but to remind us of what's at stake. Because the other difference, there's multiple differences between the book and the movie and the TV show. But one of the big changes the TV show makes that's different from both previous versions is that Percy actually knows his mom is alive throughout the entire series. So this is what's driving him to complete the quest and get it done on time. Whereas in the book and the movie, he doesn't realize that until his interaction with Hades.
Yeah, totally. And you know, we get told about the history of trying to get him into different boarding schools and like why that's so complex in the book, but it's very much a tell. Whereas here in the series, because we have more time and because we have this, I think, really good use of flashback, we get it shown to us. And so it's much more impactful.
Yeah, I will say one of the flashbacks that doesn't work for me, it doesn't involve his mom, but it does involve Luke, who is eventually revealed to be the person who's been manipulated by Kronos to instigate this war between all the gods. So in the final episode, we get flashbacks to Luke training Percy, and this is how Percy is able to battle Ares on the beach. And it works, if only because it reminds us that Luke is a character in the show, because, of course, we left him back at camp. We only saw him one other time when we used the iris something or other to touch base with him. And, you know, if you can't figure out that Luke is the one doing it in that moment, then I feel like you're not watching the show very closely. But the flashback in the finale was tricky because I think it's really important for, reminding us, hey, Luke is involved in this. This is how Percy came to fight. This is the friend who's going to betray him as prophesized. But it felt very awkwardly intercut with the fight with Ares, which I think is part of the reason why we both felt like that fight was too short.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think that might have been more effective if we had seen some of that in the early camp scenes and like flashed back to it more to remind us than to give us more exposition, which is kind of what happens in that moment.
Yeah. I mean, we spent so little time at camp. That was one of my big takeaways, is the series really wants to hit the road. And I understand that because it's a little bit more episodic, so it's kind of easier for people to jump on board as they go. But as you rightfully mentioned earlier, you know, it gives us a peril of the week, monster of the week, and so on. But it feels like Percy arrives at this Camp Half-Blood, meets a half dozen characters, and then the next episode was like, you've got a quest to go on.
Yeah, that really is it. And I didn't go back and look, obviously, but I remember the camp taking up more real estate in the book.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I thought that was an interesting choice, but you're right. It is, the goal is to move to the Monster of the Week. Like, we get a new god every week, and that's kind of fun. Like,
it is. Yeah.
I can see how, especially if we're thinking about it not as something we binge all at once, but as a show that comes out every week, which I think it was. Right? Yeah.
We released the first two episodes together, and then it was weekly after that. So that's how I was watching it. And I will say, it definitely drove anticipation. Like, the episodes are just a little too short, so that I was salivating by the end of it. Like, no, please don't end. I just want to watch the next one.
I want to know who the next god is. Yeah. And you lose a lot of that, because I binged it over a couple of days, and you lose a lot of that. And instead, you have the experience that I had, which is that the structure does feel like, okay, who are we going to kill off this week?
Samey. Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. But overall, worked for me really well. I think it's really fun. I'm sort of bummed that it's as middle grady as it is in the other direction for me, because as you know, Joe, I have a kid who's obsessed with mythology, and he will love this show when he's a little bit bigger. It's a bit too perilous for the Groot right now. But yeah.
A little too scary. Yeah.
And I think I got more out of the show this time because I know way more about Greek mythology than I did when we first read the book. Because my life is Greek mythology.
Oh, interesting. Okay, because I definitely had a fairly basic but like solid foundation in Greek mythology. So the book and the film were no problem to me, except for, you know, some of the really side characters. But like, you know, the moment where we go to the Lotus Eater Casino, I immediately knew what to expect. Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, I read a couple of different think pieces about like, here are the big changes between the book and the movie and the TV show. And a lot of them are pretty minor. Like, this is a fairly faithful adaptation, which of course is what Reardon wanted. It's why he hated that film so much, because they had to cut so much out just to get it down to a 2-hour runtime. And one of the things that people noted is that it feels like Percy and Annabeth and Grover are so much smarter in this. Like, they actually know their Greek mythology, or they know the history of the gods well enough that they're never walking in and being blindsided like they are in both the book and the film. And that was actually really satisfying, because these characters are smart enough to survive multiple dangerous encounters in the real world, and yet the book and the film would have us believe that, oh, you know, they're constantly just walking in and being blindsided and somehow still surviving.
Well, and the TV show makes a much bigger point of the idea that these stories and legends, even aside from the later discovery about Poseidon and parentage and all that stuff, like, telling these stories was a major point of connection between Percy and his mom. And so, like, he knows all these stories like the back of his hand. It makes way more sense this way.
So can we talk a little bit about the trio of lead performances? Because not only are these actors a little bit more age appropriate, I think they're about a year or two older than their characters are meant to be. But I think that also results in some occasionally uneven acting choices. I believe that these are all relative newcomers. I think Scoble has worked on like one mainstream film, The Adam Project, with Ryan Reynolds for Netflix. But overall, what did you think of the kids?
I actually really liked them all.
Okay.
I especially liked the portrayal of Annabeth. I thought she was great. I found her fun and a smart ass. And I really liked the final scene where she's like, she's going to be with her father instead of going back to camp. And Percy's like, try to just be a kid. And she's like, he wants to take me to this place called Disney World. Is that threatening? Is that bad? I'm like, you're adorable. You're really, really
cute. What do I need to know?
So I don't know. I liked the chemistry between the three of them. I really believed their emerging friendship over time.
Right.
I think Grover has the hardest role of the three because Grover is not a child, but is a child. And that's a difficult role to perform. And I think there's times when his performance is maybe weaker than the other two. But I don't know. Overall, all three of them really work for me.
Okay. This is interesting because I actually found that Sava Jeffries was my sort of weakest in terms of acting. Like sometimes she was really good. Sometimes I found her delivery just a little bit. Maybe we need another take there. So I think maybe this is a bit more of a personal preference, but I was always willing to go along with it because it felt like they were better embodying the characters. Yes. Like the age appropriateness was really key for this series, which is why I'm actually a little trepidatious that even though we're getting a second season, these kids are already, you can see pictures of them and they look 4 years older So I'm interested to see how we're going to do it. But, you know, if anything, it really reminded me of that first Harry Potter film where it was like, you can see that they're going to grow into this and they're probably going to be very good, strong actors. And this is just, you know, a slight wobble as we get used to being on this stage, this platform and so on.
Yeah, I buy that. I think what worked for me the most about them is the three of them together. Like, I think that they do a really good job, especially because they have more time and space to do it, of building the relationship between the three of them. And, you know, because we constantly have this tension between, like, do we trust each other? Do we not? Like, what does what the Oracle told Percy really mean? Like, is one of these three going to betray? And so it takes about three episodes to kind of, like, build that relationship together. And then they're, like, solid. And I enjoyed that.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so thinking about episode three, I agree with you. I feel like that's where things really started to come together in terms of, okay, we can trust each other enough to help save each other's lives. This is also the much publicized, much written about Medusa episode. Yeah. And I sent you an article that suggested that they, at least in the writer's room and the depiction by the actress, who is Jessica Parker Kennedy, they really tried to change or acknowledge the way that Medusa is more of a tragic figure. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts about this.
I mean, like, I liked this episode fine. So they play a lot on the parallels between Medusa and Athena's daughter, right? Because it's the idea that, like, they both admire her, but they admire her from a distance because Athena doesn't let anybody get close to her. So Annabeth is simultaneously repulsed by and afraid of Medusa because it's her mom who turned her into a monster, and also feels like this connection and this relationship to her because of this extended arm's length relationship to Athena. So, like, I liked the complexity of that. I thought that was really interesting. But yeah, the article that you sent me was kind of like just all the writers and showrunners patting themselves on the back for being feminist heroes. And I was like, I'm not sure the episode persuaded me that that's what was happening.
Yeah, I felt the same way. I probably should have just sent it to you without giving my commentary. But when I read it, you know, they go to great lengths to, yes, congratulate and pat themselves on the back for saying, oh, we're doing a more nuanced depiction of this. You know, we're not saying rape, but we're trying to acknowledge it. But also we're being responsible and suggesting that this is a show for middle grade audiences. And I was just like, well, you can't have it both ways.
No, you can't.
Like, and the reality is that in the finished product, it's not clear. Like, what they're congratulating themselves for doing, it's not evident on the screen in the dialogue. I think if anything, what they should do is compliment themselves for the costuming, because I really enjoyed this visual depiction of Medusa. So instead of just having her with, you know, the snakes on the head and she's slithering around, this is an almost austere woman, and she's calm and she is tragic, up until the point where she has a weird about face, and then she decides, okay, well, I guess I'm going to try to kill you.
Yeah, I guess in this article that you sent, Joe, they talk about how it was really important to them to not make Medusa ugly, but to mm-hmm. have her continue to be beautiful throughout her curse, which I think is an interesting, it's an interesting quote-unquote feminist move, because I've also seen a lot of depictions of Medusa where she's still beautiful. Like, Medusa is usually depicted as being really hot but with snakes, so I'm not sure why they think they're doing something like super radical. I guess because she's elegant more than she's hot. I don't know. The whole thing was just kind of weird. But I agree with you. I love the costuming. I love the way they use sort of a 20s style veil to shield her eyes. Mm-hmm. And I loved the way, even once she is like that disguise is taken away, we still never look her in the eye, obviously, because we can't. But I liked that the audience also can't look her in the eye. Like, I thought that was a very clever approach to Medusa.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know. They're very proud of the fact that Perseus is holding Medusa's head in an inversion of the famous statue. And
right.
Okay. But okay. Obviously that was always going to happen because Percy can't die in episode 3. So.
Yeah. I'm curious, in terms of the other gods or the other episodes, did you have favorites or particular moments that stood out?
I really, really loved Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hermes.
I mean, of course you did. I knew you would.
I thought it was great. I actually liked the whole casino episode. Like, I think everything about the parallel between Lotus Eaters and gamblers was quite clever.
Mm-hmm. And it works better here because it's not a quick moment that we need to get through in the film. This is actually, like, it's a proper full-length episode where we just get to spend it there.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You really get to live in the world, and, like, the ways in which the kids are constantly realizing time is moving too quickly and then forgetting. And, like, you can just believe the conceit because you have more time to spend in it.
Mm-hmm.
And this lesson that they learn, in that it's easier to lose yourself when you're by yourself than when you're with your people, is like, it works well. It's I think it's a good episode, but I don't know. Lin-Manuel Miranda is obviously very charming, and Hermes is obviously an a-hole. So like, that juxtaposition works really well. You know, he's cast a tiny bit against type here. He does not sing. But I think that in general, it just works really well. Like, it's very funny to see him portraying this, like, gambling, like, doesn't care about the kids. It worked for me. I liked it, and I thought that the driving scene in that episode was particularly cute. I think it worked a lot better than in the film.
Yeah. One of the things I came to appreciate about the show, particularly in the back half, is that even though I sometimes felt like it was a bit expedited, I enjoyed that it wasn't a road trip that was taking forever on the road. Like, when we needed to get to somewhere quickly, it was like, cool, we've got this magic car and now we're just on the beach.
There's something great too about, like, these children only have to drive, like, not even probably 500 meters, but it's so terrifying to them. It's just, their reactions work really well. Their chemistry in the car works really well. It's just, it's a very cute scene. And I like those moments in the series because we have more space to be a little bit more playful in this adaptation. Mm-hmm. They can lean into the humor. They can lean into the sort of set pieces and bits a bit more.
Right.
And I think that makes it a more enjoyable watch.
Yeah. I agree with that. I will say my favorite was probably Jay Duplass as Hades, in some of the same ways that we were praising Medusa for a different take on a very familiar character. I like how Jay Duplass was just kind of unambiguously a bit of a sly trickster, but I think I'm just really used to the Disney animated version, where he's so over the top and nefarious that you can't even look at him without thinking, oh, well, there's a capital V villain.
I was going to say, he's evil with jazz hands.
Yeah, exactly. Which I love. Like, I love the Disney animated version of Hercules and how we're playing with that. But, you know, I liked that we've had so many big characters on the show up until this episode. And really, the depiction of the underworld, it's so big and broad in terms of scope. Like, I don't know. I find it hard to do something interesting because we always just go gray and we always have, like, a couple of corpses and that sort of thing. And visually, this isn't the most exciting episode. So I appreciated that this Hades felt like he was cut from a different cloth than what we're normally used to seeing.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I really do. I liked the underworld a lot. I think that scene of like the lineup of people waiting for the boat was really well done. Like, whew, yeah, that's a level of bleak.
Yes.
I did say to you before we started recording that like I, you know, the CGI critic over here was really actually impressed by pretty much all the monsters.
Yeah.
Except Cerberus, unfortunately. And as you said, it's hard to make a three-headed dog. I think the issue is that like the dog is a normal dog width of body. And then they have the three heads just kind of like two of the heads just kind of shoehorned onto the shoulders instead of making the dog itself wider. Like I'm a Cerberus expert over here. But yeah, there were moments where it was just a real bummer because that was the only moment in the series where I really felt like the effects kind of undercut
it, let it down.
The intention of the scenes. Because he's not very scary because he's very weird looking.
Yeah, and you know, this was one of the many small changes that we make, which is that in the book, Annabeth just plays with the dog and it lets them go because it actually likes her and it whines when she leaves.
Yeah.
Whereas here, of course, we have to go the more traditional action movie route, and this dog will just not give up. And this scene in particular felt very Harry Potter influenced, not just because it's the same character. And I appreciate, you know, I think we even talked about this when we watched the film. It's like, yeah, by sheer proximity of when the texts are published and the characters that we're playing with, of course, we're going to see repeats or they're going to be in conversation to each other. But this didn't feel different to me. The creature design looked too similar and not in a good way. And Yeah, it's just real hard to make a three-headed dog scary.
Yeah, unfortunately. Because really, yeah, the rest of the character design, you know, when the mom disappears and stuff, like all of that actually worked really well. Much better than in the film, which I thought was interesting. I mean, some of that is just like improvement of effects over time.
Sure.
But yeah, almost everything worked well for me.
Yeah. I will say, I think my favorite special effect is when we have to go and get the shield and Percy sacrifices himself to sit on the chair and it coats him in gold. And I really like that.
Yeah. The slow motion way it takes him over is great.
And that was properly scary. Like, I think if you were a younger viewer, you would look at that and be horrified.
Yeah, there were some moments where I knew for sure it was good. I wasn't watching it with my kiddo. Kronos at the end is also terrifying. Like, there's no way my kid would have survived that scene. But yeah, there's something particularly in the performance there that's really good, right? He's because he can't move and he's telegraphing terror just with his eyes. He's doing a very good job.
Yeah. Okay. Do we have final thoughts about Percy Jackson? Are you at all interested in watching the second season when it debuts?
Yeah, I would. I think we'll have to read the second book.
Yes. Which would give us an opportunity to then also watch the second film, because remember, there was a sequel.
Yeah. I'm less stoked I'm about less the excited second about film. That one. But yeah, no, I'm interested to see how these actors age into these characters. And I'm interested to see which celebrities line up for season two to be the God of the Week, because I'm sure there are many.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I feel the same way. You know, I think that this is a project where it's finally being represented in the way that fans had always hoped or anticipated it would be. So I'm actually really happy for them, even if it's not my preferred favorite middle grade / YA text. It's always nice when we get a second kick at the can and it seemingly goes down quite a bit better for the people who really like it. So happy for folks. I don't know. I mean, I think there's enough interest in what the series is doing. It sounds like it gets more complex because apparently Luke's whole history and him being corrupted by Kronos and this great prophecy involving Percy and why Kronos needs to keep him alive, which is that sort of dangling plot thread that we get in the final episode of the show. These are all big things that are going to drive, I think it's like 5 books in the series. Right. So I'm like, ooh, okay, I do love a mythology. So I'm interested to see how that will develop as well.
Yeah, and I actually think the actor playing Luke is good and underused, obviously, in season one. So I'm excited to see how that develops further.
Me too. I liked his relationship with Percy, and the chemistry between the two actors was really good. So I'm actually hoping we'll see more conflict or, you know, more luring to the dark side in future seasons.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay. Shall we play some YA bingo?
Definitely.
Bingo!
Not a good bingo.
Okay. Right. So we definitely have ableism in the school system. Like, oh my gosh, there's really no school that will teach this kid?
Well, and it's interesting too, right? Because I'd forgotten that in the book, he apparently has ADHD and dyslexia. Yeah. And they're treated as symptoms of, oh, it's because you're actually a demigod and, you know, you should be reading in Greek and that kind of stuff. But yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, we have CanCon filmed in Vancouver.
Oh.
The lushest, glorious coastal mountains of northern New York State that are the backdrop of the camping scene make me laugh every time. I think that we have a lot of dead bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we definitely are on borrowed time, right?
Oh,
the
yes.
quest literally has a time limit, so that's key.
Uh-huh. I like the fact that we don't make it in this adaptation.
Yeah.
So in the book and the film, we do make it with time to spare. And here it's like, oh no, we're too late to stop the war. And I like that escalation of tension.
Yeah, I do too. It also is more believable.
Truly.
Obviously, you have a giant road trip and a chosen one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that most of the adults would qualify as stunt casting here.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've also got some magic and supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
Just a touch.
Just a little bit.
And then I'm going to say coincidental classes, even though obviously if you were at camp, you would learn how to do a variety of different activities. But it does seem like everything that we have learned ends up coming into play on our road trip.
Yeah, literally every single skill. It's pretty funny. And good friendships. I really like what emerges between the three protagonists. And I think it works way better in the TV series than it did in the film.
Yeah, I don't know if it's just that the actors are more comfortable with each other, or maybe it's more believable because they are younger, or we just, you know, get 7.5 hours or whatever. It just works better here, doesn't it?
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. Okay, so we are super, super close, but we're actually missing out on some key blocks, so we didn't quite make a line.
Boo! Boo, Percy Jackson. You're dead to me. Not doing your book too.
That's a lie. That's not true.
Okay, folks. Well, hopefully you enjoyed our little foray into mythology. We're going to stay in the world of middle grade fantasy next week as we check out the Spiderwick Chronicles for the first time, Joe.
Yeah. Truthfully, don't know too much about this one, but obviously there is a new TV series coming out with Christian Slater on Roku. So we'll see if we get some screeners, we may check that out as well. But for now, we're definitely doing a book as well as the film.
That's correct. And if you'd like to write in and let us know what you thought of the Percy Jackson adaptation, especially if you're a fan, we'd love to hear from you.
Mm-hmm.
You can find us on most social media at HKHSPod or on the hashtag HKHSPod. Joe, where do they find you?
I can be reached at Beast on my remote, and that's the letter B.
And I'm at Brenna C. Gray, that's Gray with an A, and we would love for you to write in for our mailbag, HKHSPod@gmail.com.
Nice.
Yeah. This was fun, Joe. I do not regret watching this series.
Oh, good. Yeah, no, I completely agree. And just in closing off, I wanted to give listener Caitlin a shout out, who did inquire whether we would finally be covering this. So Caitlin, hope you enjoyed the episode.
Nice. All right, folks. Well, until next time, I will see you on the page.
And I will see you on the screen. So, of course, this is based on the book series by... Is it Dan O'Riordan? No.
Rick.
That's not right.
Rick Riordan.
So, of course, this is based on the book series by Rick Riordan.
I think it's just Riordan.
I know.
Did my bing thing just bing?
No, you were fine.
Okay, good.
It was actually good because I was like, oh, there's a pause where I can put the trailer.